Hello and welcome to the broadcast ministry of the Evangelical Methodist Church in Darlington, Maryland, where Dr. John McKnight is the pastor. On today's program, we'll hear a monologue by Dr. Edward Panosian, Chairman Emeritus of the Department of Social Science at Bob Jones University, where he has taught history on the graduate and undergraduate levels for more than 50 years. Dr. Panosian was at our church during the occasion of the 62nd Annual Convention of the American Council of Christian Churches. He was invited as a guest speaker to bring some of his history in the first person monologues. Today's program is on the life of John Bunyan. And here is Dr. Edward Panosian.
Good afternoon. Let me say again with hearty, genuine intent how much I appreciate the time with you gentlemen and ladies, the privilege of ministering here with you and being ministered to. I wholeheartedly concur with the emphasis on biblical separation, moral purity, gospel preaching, godly families, and the passing of the baton to the next generation. This has been a refreshment to my soul, a benediction to my intent and purpose, and I applaud you and the ministry of everybody who's had a part in this, including those who prepared such delicious lunches for us, and for Don and Peggy Nixon and their kind and detailed attention to all the aspects of this conference. 325 years ago, this year, was published a book, the title page of which reads, "The Pilgrim's Progress from This World to That Which Is to Come," wherein is described the manner of his setting out, his dangerous journey, and at last his safe arrival at the desired country, delivered under the similitude of a dream, and then the reference at the bottom of the page to Hosea 12, where the prophet says, "I have used similitudes." This is the publication which has been translated into more languages, edited and published in more versions, scattered throughout more countries of the world than any other book in history which was written originally in English. I take you in your imagination, please, this afternoon to 17th century England, to a town of Elstow, Ellen's Stockade, Helena, the mother of Constantine. The town was named after her. Some 2 or 3 miles from Bedford, where was a jail. Now the first page of that book, The Pilgrim's Progress, begins, "As I walked through the wilderness of this world, I lighted upon a certain place where there was a den. And I lay down in that den and slept. And as I slept, I dreamed. And in my dream, I saw a man with a heavy burden on his back, with a book in his hand. And he cried out, 'What shall I do?'" This is the book by John Bunyan, B-U-N-Y-A-N, not that sore on your toe, Bunyan. And not Paul Bunyan. I had a student who misunderstood that. He wasn't going around planting seeds of trees around the country. Born to Thomas and Margaret Bunyan. Thomas, his father, was a tinker. Now, only a few of you know who, what was a tinker. A tinker was a worker in metal who made and repaired pots and pans and implements of farm and kitchen. He went around from village to village on a wheeled brazier, a forge, and he repaired pots and pans. They were not thrown away if they earned a hole. They were repaired. It was an honorable profession, occupation, and my father was well recognized from village to village. I say my father. I want to assume now the character of this red-haired, broad-shouldered, common man who in his boyhood was a terror to the community. I set out to be, and very well nearly succeeded to be, the worst young boy in town. I took pleasure in being known as, well, mischievous is too kind a word. I was a reprobate. I had an ungodly tongue. I engaged in activities that were frowned upon by godly people. The Puritans had forbidden in England in the 17th century Sunday sports. I heard a resolution earlier this week. And I would delight in causing wonder and amazement and fear in the town by playing sports in my little village on Sunday when godly people did not do that. I was a bell ringer. I used the town bell for no reason to excite the populace. In those days, the bell was the means by which news was transmitted throughout the town. There were no media, as you know it. Bells, one bell of one tone was capable of communicating many different messages. There was an alarum bell which rang rapidly and suggested that something was on fire, there was danger of some kind. There was a tolling bell that rang very slowly, announcing the death of someone in town, and people would go to one another and ask who and when and who, and the news would travel. There were joyful bells that rang out good news. It is not for nothing that at Christmas time you associate bells with your decorations. Ring out, Wild, ring out the news, the old, ring in the new. I would at odd hours and for no reason climb up, grab the rope and ring the bell and startle the town and make them wonder what was going on. This was more than mischief. It was not destructive, to be sure, but I took pleasure in a reputation. I had a blasphemous tongue. But as the apostle pled with heaven three times for the removal of that thorn in the flesh and received the answer from heaven, "My grace is sufficient for thee," that text became the text which hovered over my life all my days. God's grace was protecting me from worse. And I could later say, if all the adulterers and fornicators in England were hanged by the neck till they be dead, John Bunyan would be still alive. God's grace kept me from moral impurity, though I was seeking to be an evil young man. My mother died after my elementary grammar school education. My father remarried, and his second wife, my stepmother, and I did not mesh. She was happy to be rid of me when at 16 I entered the Parliamentarian Army and for 2.5 years served in Cromwell's army. And God's grace continued to be sufficient for me. On two occasions I was spared from certain death while in the army. On one occasion, almost drowned. On the other occasion, someone else was substituted, not at my urging, for a post to which I had been assigned. At the last minute, someone else was assigned to it, and he was decapitated by a cannonball. And but for the grace of God, that would have been I. And I was conscious that something was brooding over me which I did not deserve, nor did I desire it. I came back from the army. I married at the age of 18 and a half. I married a poor orphan girl. We were about the same, the two of us. Her entire dowry left her by her father was two tattered books. One was entitled The Practice of Piety. The other was The Poor Man's Pathway to Heaven. We needed both. Together, and I mean it took both of us, we read through those little tattered books. And there grew in me now a desire to gain an opposite reputation from that to which I had earned before. I set out to be a remarkable young man of piety and promise, as I was remarkable for my evil and proud of it. I now became proud of my upright living, and I was equally damned in my soul. I, in the process of this transformation by my own bootstraps, I began to attend Pastor Gifford's little Baptist church in this little town. And Pastor Gifford was a good and godly man. And he preached truth. And he wooed sinners and pled with the Spirit of God to move in the hearts of his hearers. And when he concluded his message, every time he urged those present to close with Christ. Close with Christ. That was his phrase. There had been a breach by sin. A bridge had been erected by the reconciliation of Jesus Christ. But be ye reconciled unto God. And often as he pled with those who heard, the water stood in my eyes, but I would not let it fall. And I overheard one day my dear wife, who by then had borne a daughter to our home, who was soon blind. My wife's name was Mary. We named our blind daughter after her mother, Blind Mary. I overheard my wife praying quietly, not knowing I was listening. I overheard my dear, young, ignorant, but perceptive young mother. I overheard her praying, "Dear God, help my poor husband. He is more sightless than Mary." And that struck near. I had looked upon religion, Christianity, as do's and don'ts, as laws and requirements and obligations. And I didn't think I could hold out. And I didn't like being told what to do. And then a second thing occurred. I guess a third thing, in addition to Pastor Gifford's preaching, my wife Mary's praying, I came upon four ladies in the town, in the congregation, on the porch of one of them, in a weekday, talking together. I overheard their conversation, in which they described the Christian life as a divine life kindled in the soul. That was a new thing for me. That was not obligations and duties and prohibitions and exhortations. It was something within. And the Spirit of God, as His grace was sufficient, worked in all three of those avenues to bring me again to hear Pastor Gifford preach, again to hear his invitation to close with Christ, again for the water to stand in the eyes. But this time, at the age of 25, the water fell from my eyes, and I closed with Christ. And now, broad shoulders, red hair, flowing, walrus mustache of red hair, a common man, an unlettered man. But now the grace of God had appeared in my own heart, and I was born anew, born from above. I was baptized by Pastor Gifford at the age of 25 and then began to give my testimony anywhere I could. I cared not where. I was no ordained preacher, never was ordained preacher, never had an education beyond grammar school, didn't know books. I said it was with difficulty that my wife and I read those two tattered books. But I began to read the Bible. And the Bible began to be my meat and my food and my sustenance and my instruction and my exhortation and my joy. And as I was tinkering following my father's occupation, I too became a tinker. I came to be known as the tinker of Elstow, or the tinker of Bedford, because Bedford was going to be my home for many years. I gave my testimony in farmhouses and fields, in towns and schoolhouses, wherever people would gather and invite me to come, and all I did was tell what God had done for me. And the grace of God was bearing fruit, and I heard of a lady who had been saved as a result of hearing my testimony. And I felt as if I were a diver who had brought up from the depths of the sea a pearl of matchless price. And I said, I care not if I be fruitless. It matters not who commends me. But if I be fruitful, I care not who does condemn. That motto stayed with the years. And soon I began to preach. And my text was more than my own testimony, but it was made real by my having a real testimony. And then a law was passed forbidding unlawful assembly. Unlawful assembly was forbidden by the Parliament out of fear of sedition and unrest. And that meant, among other things, that there could be no meetings for religious purposes either, unless they were authorized by the Church of England. Now, it's the 17th century. And by now, a century has passed of Reformation Protestantism in England. A century is beyond the days of William Tyndale. And a declension has set in. And form and liturgy and coldness and deadness and much attention to order and little to doctrine. And sermons were great antidotes to inability to sleep. What's the word I want? Insomnia, you know. And one lady said the only time she could sleep is when she went to church. There, the sermon always put her to sleep. And in such an environment, I would have nothing to do with the Church of England. The Church of England would have nothing to do with me either, unlettered, unordained. And yet I, believing God had authorized it, proceeded to give my testimony and preach wherever I was invited. On one occasion, I was invited to a farmhouse some 13 miles away from Bedford, there to meet with a people who had gathered to hear the message. News came to the group before the time of the service that the magistrate was en route to arrest me if I proceeded to preach in this unlawful assembly. I was now in a position to consider, what shall I do? I have told my people that God is able to protect them in every circumstance, that God has a will in every turn of time. And shall I now flee and deny those who have come to hear a message of truth, the hearing of that message? Or shall I wait and see what God has in store? The time for the service announced began, arrived, and I began to preach, and the magistrate arrived, and I politely asked for permission to proceed and promised that I would accompany him when I had finished. I gave out my text. Dost thou fear God? And this magistrate trembled. He thought I was talking to him. Well, I was, but it was addressed to the... And I observed his trembling, and I said to the people, see how this man trembles at the word of God. And by inference, why don't you? And I preached, and the preaching was concluded, and then I said to the magistrate, I am yours. He was embarrassed. He knew I was no trouble. I was no potential rabble-rouser. He knew me. He knew of me. And yet the law was his responsibility. Hoping I would escape, he said to me, I'm going on before to Bedford. Follow me. He did not bind me. He was trying to give me every opportunity to flee. I followed him. The 13 miles to Bedford jail. I don't know what you know about 17th century England, but a jail, a prison in the 17th century in England housed three kinds of people. One were criminals who ought to be there. A second were debtors who had not paid their debts. And I never thought it was sensible to put debtors in prison. They'll never pay their debts in prison. But apparently the law did not agree. And the third group were what we today call mentally ill people, insane folk, whom today we put into separate asylums. But they were put in as crazy folk in this conglomeration of the rabble of humanity. And I'm thrown in with them in these large room cells and forbidden to preach to my people, but not forbidden to preach. Talk about a congregation of needy sinners. It was thrust in my lap, and the grace of God was sufficient for me. And I preached to them, and I lived with them. I endured deprivation with them. In those days, the government did not provide the board of those whom they provided room in prison. They gave them a cell, but not food. Food had to come from your own family. My poor family. By now, two daughters. One of them blind, dependent on me. A certificate, a paper, a document was placed outside the cell door, which if I reached for it and signed it any day, hour of the week, of month or year, I would be released. A document in which I promised not to preach again without lawful permission of the Church of England. I said, I will not sign that paper if moss grows on my eyebrows. And it was not a far-fetched illusion. It was damp. It was vermin-ridden. And my eyebrows were weighty and flowing and red. I would not sign. That paper had to be regularly replaced as it was eaten by rats. But I would not. And I said, my poor family dependent on me, their father, husband. I feel as if I am a man pulling down the roof of his house upon his family. And yet I must do it. I must do it. God gave fruit in the prison. And for 6 years, from 1660 to 1666, I languished in that prison. Blind Mary. I had read the text of the psalmist who said, I have been young, now I am old, but I have never seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. I could not abide blind Mary begging on the street. So I acquired, I don't remember how, a large spool of heavy twine. And I cut it into lengths about a yard long. And with a thin thread wound about an inch at each end to stiffen the ends and thus make them usable as laces for boots and shoes. And I would pass them out through the cell to my family, and blind Mary would stand on the street and sell tagged laces, long tagged laces. The tags were the stiffened ends. So as to provide some livelihood, for I was loath to take food from their hands for my own body. I, the provider of a home and family, who with the stroke of a pen could rejoin them. But confident in the grace of God that it has sustained me, I would not. Released in 6 years, in 1666, a temporary change in the law, and I went about preaching again. My wife Mary had died. I remarried. Elizabeth was her name. We had two more daughters. And I thought life was going to be restored to normalcy. And imprisonment for 6 more years followed. 12 years of a 60-year lifespan, as it turned out. 6 more years of prison. Now 4 daughters and increased difficulty. But God's continued grace, more than sufficient. And then released after 6 more years to what surely must have been the end of his imprisonments. And for 3 years enjoyed freedom with my family. And in 1675, imprisoned once again for what turned out to be 6 months this time. Would not 12 years have been sufficient? But in the providence and will of God, 6 months more. But it was in those last 6 months, in 1675, while in prison, then I conceived the idea of the Pilgrim's Progress. And but for those last 6 months, that book might never have been written. In 1675, having been born 375 years ago next month, and the book was published 325 years ago this year, a simple book. The source of it was 2 books only. When later young theologues came from London, to which I had been invited, but to which I would never go, for I was no London preacher. I knew it, and everyone else would soon know it if I ever went there. They came and asked to see my library. It consisted of 2 books. The Bible and John Fox's Book of Martyrs. That was my library. Oh, in later years, it included publishers' copies of books that I had written and pamphlets and monographs, but they were hardly illuminating to me. A total of 60 works of various kinds in 60 years. Someone has estimated 1 million words from the pen of this ignorant tinker. Dr. John Owen, the Puritan pastor in London, was once introduced to the king, Charles II, and the king said to Dr. Owen, of some reputation as a Puritan scholar, Dr. Owen, why do you, as a man of such esteem and scholarship, go to hear that ignorant tinker preach? And Dr. Owen kindly replied, Your Majesty, I would gladly surrender my esteemed scholarship if I could preach like that ignorant tinker. God used the book. God used the biography. Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. That was the title of my autobiography. And it was more than just a nice title. It was an affirmation of the years of my days. Grace Abounding. I wrote The Holy War, the conflict of the pilgrim, the Christian, in the world. And it is instructive. I was to learn in glory that Charles Spurgeon would regularly read through The Pilgrim's Progress at least once a year. A book which contains, on some pages, several pages in succession, in which one cannot find a word of more than two syllables. A simple book, but a book that reflects the life of the Christian and that translates the content of the Scripture into the path of the pilgrim. I say, as I walk through the wilderness of this world, that was my life before I met Christ. It was a wilderness, and for every sinner it is a wilderness, however cultivated it may seem. I came upon a place where there was a den. That den was the prison cell. And in that den I slept, and while I slept I dreamed. And that dream is the Pilgrim's Progress. Someone has said one page of the tinker's writings is of more worth to humanity than all the banks of the Rothschilds. That's a generous estimate, I'm sure. But God was pleased to use not scholarship, not training, except in the crucible of life, a simple ignorant tinker. To the end of my days, I continued tinkering. Never had a salary adequate to sustain my family. My occupation was tinkering. You use that word in a different sense. I was using it quite literally. Sometimes men tinker with things to the chagrin of their wives, who would prefer calling a repairman and get it fixed right, I'm sure. I continued tinkering through the remainder of my days. And then, in 1688, another historical year, the year of the beginning of the English Revolution, which became the pattern for the American War of Independence, while returning home from a humane journey, seeking to reconcile a father and a son. The son had been disinherited by the father. The father had denounced the son, and it was a petty matter, and the son appealed to me to assist him in reconciliation, and with some degree of success, thank God. But returning home, I contracted what we called the sweating sickness, and within a few weeks, I had passed from this life to a better. The life of the tinker of Bedford. God used simple things. An ordinary man. God uses human beings. God does not look upon the gifts which indeed come from Him. He looks upon the heart of willing desire to commit those gifts to His purposes and to His noble and eternal service. The Lord used a man. The Lord still uses men and women. And His grace was sufficient for John Bunyan. His grace is still sufficient for every faithful man and woman. It is sufficient for you. It is sufficient for me. May God be praised.
That was Dr. Edward Panosian speaking on the occasion of the American Council of Christian Churches 62nd Annual Convention held at the Evangelical Methodist Church in Darlington, Maryland. Thank you for listening to this program. I am Don Nixon.